I've returned, and I have returned. I've returned in the last week from a period of a number of weeks on retreat, for the most part. I was at Spirit Rock for the February retreat, saw Sarah quite a bit. And then had about 9 days at home doing a semi-retreat, where I was still staying with a lot of practice. And then about a week where I came back last Monday from a Tibetan retreat. And so I've been mostly on retreat, and most of you have been on retreat and know that way of walking around that feels a little bit like culture shock, right? Like it's similar to times when I spend a lot of time in Asia, but I come back and I look around, look at that. Look at the way they do those stores. Look at those people with those, you know, devices. I mean, interesting, right? And seeing things both freshly, and things seem a little bit strange. Do you know that one? It's not lasting in the same way. It's decreasing, but still, that's been there. And I think the retreats can be significant deepenings. That it's always the question of how to integrate them. And that one of the themes of the retreat, as well as in the period after it, is in, it's really a theme of our meditation in general, has been into looking into how we see through various lenses and see through various limiting beliefs in ways such that we don't really see accurately. We don't really see things as they are. And I want to explore that theme. If you're interested, for the next 3 weeks. And it's something that I've been thinking about a lot, both during the retreat and after the retreat. And it's a very fundamental theme in our practice. And I think in most spiritual traditions, there's a sense that our perception, our way of seeing, is not so accurate, and that we think that we're seeing things accurately and seeing quote unquote reality, but that when we look more closely, it doesn't seem to be that. I remember that when I did my first retreat, which was at Insight Meditation Society 40 years ago. My first retreat was 2 weeks. I was a student at the time, and like many students at that time, I was very interested in the literature on altered states of consciousness. I was studying it at school. Anyone else study that material? Very interesting. And I remember going on the retreat and having my mind quiet down and really, in a way, being for large chunks of time, perceiving without concepts, experiencing without concepts mediating my experience, or apparently, certainly not the grosser concepts. And in a way, seeing more directly, we experience this sometimes, I know, on retreats, or sometimes just when the mind gets very quiet and we see the bay or the sunset or the ocean and things seem to sparkle, right? And the mind has quieted down. So I think we can experience this in meditation, but also just in certain situations where the mind, for whatever reason, quiets down and we don't see through conceptual lens. And I came out of that retreat with a slogan that was made in relationship to my studies of altered states. I said, my slogan was, civilization is an altered state of consciousness. Because it felt like I was experiencing what could be called a non-altered state, and that it wasn't ordinary consciousness. So that's one way that we can point to this theme. Again, it's a very, very powerful theme in many traditions of spirituality, in our Western culture, among poets and mystics. Many of you remember that famous line from William Blake, which was that if we could cleanse the doors of perception, we would see things as they are, infinite, from his poetry. And we know that the core metaphor in the Buddhist tradition is that we're asleep, and that our waking reality is more akin to dreaming than to really being awake. You know, so the very word Buddha, it has the root is bud, which means awake, right? That's the core metaphor, that in a sense we are as if asleep. And yet it doesn't necessarily feel like that. It feels like, oh, my ordinary mind, that's real, isn't it? This is the way things are, isn't it? And so what we do in our meditative practice, in our Dharma practice, is that we investigate that sense of whether we are really seeing accurately or seeing in a more distorted way. A few passages from the Buddha. Delusion burns the bewildered. Unaware of the noble Dhamma, unaware of the fires, they delight in self-identification. So it's pointing to something that I'll look into a little more depth in a few moments. That is, one of the main forms of distortion is that we see things through the lens of self. And I'll get to that. That's actually for us, we can see quite clearly that we often don't see clearly when we see through the lens of self. Another quotation from the Buddha. Warped perceptions are what keep your mind on fire. Right, and this is from Kabir. He's talking to himself. He says, my inside, listen to me. The great spirit, the greatest spirit, the teacher is near. Wake up, wake up. And so we have that metaphor of waking up. And again, in many Buddhist traditions as well as in other traditions, our normal experience is likened to being in a dream. It's found in many traditions, and some of you know the famous account by Chuang Tzu, where he reports Chang Chu dreaming of being a butterfly, and then he wakes up. But how can he be sure that he's not a butterfly dreaming that he's Chuang Tzu? So a lot of this is meant to startle us a little bit. The metaphors are startling. It must have been startling for the Buddha to say, remember he was asked, what are you? Are you a god? No. You know, are you what? Are you a demon? No. What are you? I am awake. That was his answer. Right? So there's some way that we're asleep. This is from a Mahayana text. And the Buddha says, "My dreamlike form appeared to dreamlike beings to show them the dreamlike path that leads to dreamlike enlightenment." And this is from the well-known Dharma text, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Martha, truth or illusion, George, you don't know the difference. Remember, George and Martha are always fighting, right? Truth or illusion, George, you don't know the difference. George, no, but we must carry on as though we did. Martha, amen. And again, there are a lot of texts where they bring forth multiple metaphors of us not seeing clearly. Sometimes the metaphor is the dream. This is from the Diamond Sutra. As a lamp, a cataract, a star in space. These are all metaphors for not seeing clearly. A cataract, a star in space, an illusion, a dewdrop at dawn, a bubble, a dream, a cloud, a flash of lightning. View all created things like this. So there are these many, many metaphors. And in a way, when a lot of the recent work in cognitive science can actually help us to see ways that we don't see so clearly, and that we don't see things as they are, that things are not the way they appear to us. Cognitive science points out that most of our thought is unconscious. Do you know that 98% of your thought is unconscious? And most of it is based on repeating metaphors, images, models that you're not aware of, that somehow got in there and formed, and structure our experience, that our brains are structured by hundreds and hundreds of metaphors and models of which we're primarily not conscious. And all of our perception is filtered through that. And it's similar to what the philosopher Kant said quite a few hundred years ago. He said that we actually don't see things as they are, but that we nonetheless have a coherence of experience because our minds, he didn't use the word brain, he said our minds are predisposed to see things as if they were solid, as if they were enduring, as if certain qualities were there, as if we could use number and count things and so forth, as if cause and effect works. But these, he said, are the deep projections of the mind. And we project on and see things, and we know that children have to learn how to see in this way, right? Children don't come into existence and immediately see trees, right? And many, many of us may know this from helping people to learn, helping kids to learn basic concepts, right? And William James, the psychologist and philosopher, said that children's experience is a buzzing, booming confusion until they learn some basic ways of seeing, again, which is different in different cultures. You're getting a sense of how, we see through certain lenses. The philosopher Wittgenstein said we are bewitched by language. We have language, which is primarily connected with our vision, that leads us to see in a certain way. Of course, languages across cultures are somewhat different, right? We have a language which has a lot of emphasis on nouns, right? So we tend to see objects. Not all cultures do that. And we tend to see solid, enduring objects. And our language does that. And there are also certain tendencies of the way our eyes work, which also do that, that we have, unlike virtually all other species, we have the images on our retina last for like a fifth of a second. And it gives us the sense that things are lasting. But in actuality, things are flickering and we're stitching them together, much like in a film with 24 frames a second, right? If you would see it more slowly, it wouldn't look continuous. You make it 24 frames a second, and we have the illusion of continuity, right? And actually, we're doing something like this. Psychologists call it flicker fusion. That things are actually flickering, but we stitch them together, partly because of the way the eyes work. And it's interesting that kind of fusion in general leads to confusion about the way things are. It's interesting, the word confusion, right? It means with the fusion of things, right? So what I wanted to do was to explore moving from the more gross to the more subtle, five ways that we don't see things as they are. And the first two are more obvious, and they're pretty accessible. And as we go into more subtlety, they're less easy to get, but we can get them with our practice. And so I'm just going to, I think, work with the first two this time, but I'll name the five that I wanted to work with. The first is that we see things in a often distorted way because we see very much through the lens of the personal self. And I'll come back to each of these. And that's not hard to see, right? It's not hard to see. A second reason is that that things are not quite as they appear, is that we see through the lens of the collectivity. We see through our social conditioning, our cultures. Again, pretty obvious, right? Not hard to understand. A third reason, which I think I'll probably work with next week, is that we don't see impermanence clearly. We think that things, even though we know intellectually that things are changing, we tend to see things as solid and unchanging. Yeah, and with all of these, I'm going to be suggesting practices to investigate them. And homework, if you so choose. No more mandatory homework, but self-selected homework, if you want to explore and practice. So the third is how we don't really see impermanence clearly. We tend to project a certain permanence on. Again, some of this comes from language and habits. The fourth is, these last ones are somewhat interrelated. The fourth is that we tend to see separate beings and objects as if they are separate, independent, and solid, rather than seeing interdependence.
Could you repeat that?
That we tend to see beings and objects as separate, independent, and solid. Whereas in fact, they are none of them. Rather interdependent, not separate, and not solid. And then lastly, we tend to see ourselves as separate from everything else. We tend to operate with a fundamental duality. But when we look much more closely, again, this is subtle, when we look much more closely, the duality evaporates. And we are not really separate from all other things, even though we tend to see the world that way. And of course, as we see these five aspects more clearly, of course, it can lead to changes in how we act and how we understand ourselves. One of the natural results of seeing in these five ways, I think, is to develop more compassion, right? Because we can see how the whole world is going, much of the world is going around really dominated by not seeing clearly. Or there's a line that I like from Shanti Deva, which I probably have given here before, from the 8th century. How does it go? This world... this world is full, I'm paraphrasing, I think. This world is full of the insanity. This world is full of the efforts of those. This world is filled with insanity due to the efforts of those who are confused about themselves. Right? So there's some fundamental lack of knowing oneself clearly, knowing oneself well. That's at the root of so much suffering. And so when we actually see this more clearly in ourselves, one of the results is compassion and wanting to help. And it's, again, it's one of the shocks of coming from retreat and looking at the headline in the New York Times today, which was one of the lead articles was a study of whether... our president knows the difference between when he is lying or when he is just repeating uninformed information. Right? So, so those are the five, and that compassion, I think, is a result of it. But it's also my experience is that as we look more clearly into ways that we don't see clearly, as we look more at ways that we may not see things accurately, that aspect of compassion is important to bring to oneself as well. And so if you're actually actively following some of the practices I also suggest doing something like metta or compassion practice, because I don't know, in my own experience, sometimes looking carefully at this can be a little bit disorienting. And if one looks deeply at it. So, okay. Okay, so the first, I think I'll work with first two, and then we'll work with the latter three and the next period of time. If you like this topic, if you don't, something else maybe, but hopefully you do. It's really interesting to me. It was the basis for a lot of my retreat. I was actually, for the first time, I was doing some practice with dreams, which was pretty cool, where I would actually explore keeping awareness during dreams as best I could. So it would be like when I was on retreat at Spirit Rock for, 4 weeks or so, I would do like 16 or 17 hours of practice. Then it'd be time to go to sleep. And I'd say, oh, another 7 hours of practice. It was cool. It was really, I hadn't done that ever before. And I would have an alarm that would wake me up three or four times during the night and basically say, I had a little message recorded and say, what is your state of mind? And would basically try to keep awareness going. It's not easy. I had slow progress. But I did have a few times when I was able deliberately to go back into a dream and be lucid. That was, maybe some of you have explored, anyone explored lucid dreams? Oh, a lot of you, well, cool, maybe we can talk about that later. But isn't it interesting? I was really excited, even though my progress, I would say, was limited. I was really excited, you know, tired, end of the day, oh, more practice. It was cool. So the first of these is that we see, not surprisingly, through the lens of the self in ways that are distorting. And again, not hard to see how we do this. Again, I'm starting with the ways that we don't see clearly or accurately that are pretty accessible. You know, there's a famous line that some of you may have heard, which is sometimes attributed to the Talmud, which goes, "We don't see things as they are, we see things as we are." Have you heard that one? Right. I researched a little bit, and it's very vaguely connected to the Talmud, but people like to say that it is. Yeah. I'll ask for a few examples from you, but for me, I was thinking, you know, again, it's not hard to see. You know, I was thinking of a few examples. One of them I remember driving from San Rafael back to Berkeley when there was really bad traffic, and the traffic was kind of blocked up, and I saw a car going down the breakdown lane, and I immediately said, "So selfish." And then my mind went with proper proliferation to, "Things are just getting more selfish in our world." And it just went on for a while like that. Have you ever done that? Right, and then, you know, 5 minutes later, the traffic had moved some, and I saw the same car was stopped with a car that had broken down. So it got, you know, a quick, karmic feedback. Very helpful. And many of us have had, so that came to mind, or another example was the one from, do you remember in Ferguson when the police officer killed Michael Brown? And his testimony was that, these are his actual words, that when he looked at Michael Brown, he said, "The only way that I can describe it," this is what he said in court, "the only way I can describe it, he looked like a demon." That's how angry he looked. So he saw him as a demon. And demons don't have rights. Right? So he killed him. Right? And you know, another example I remember was from, I remember in college, studying psychology, I remember reading the account, maybe some of you read this, it was a classic account in social psychology of how there was like a kind of what people called a riot at a football game, where people from different sides of a college football game from the stands, they just started fighting each other. And the social psychologist got the testimony of people on both sides, and they were completely diametrically opposite. It was as if they were describing completely different realities, right? Yeah. What occurs to you as some ways that you see through the lens of self? Maybe we can use the microphone. Could someone help bring that along? So think of an example. It could be just very ordinary, of how you don't see clearly because you see through the lens of self. That would mean seeing through our likes, our dislikes, our reactivity. Just in a, should be very, very familiar.
I don't know exactly what you mean, but it comes to mind. My kids were younger. The pediatrician, one of my children was very sick. The pediatrician said, "Call me over the weekend, I'll be available." Mm-hmm. And of course I did, and he wasn't. And you can imagine how I was so pissed.
Yeah.
And his wife had committed suicide that weekend.
What's that?
His wife had committed suicide.
Oh, yeah.
And I think of that so often, of how I made a presumption because I was so
Right. So I think that's a very, very clear example. I mean, reminds me of how, you know, in teaching a lot on the judgmental mind, The judgmental mind does that all the time. Something occurs, I don't like it, and my mind just makes assumptions. You know, I sometimes have taught here on the model of the ladder of inference. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. I've taught a few times on that, which is a very simple model developed in the business world, where the ladder of inference is where one moves from basic data to selecting out certain data, which already brings aspect of self with it, to finding meaning, making assumptions, adopting beliefs. Now, the ordinary way the mind works. Mm-hmm. But when we're reactive, we will go from some raw data to fixed and fast assumptions and beliefs pretty quickly. So that's a very good example. Another example?
Well, this is more physical, but there was some reactivity. Last year, I noticed that all the lupin were the wrong color.
That all the...
The lupin, they were just off.
Yeah.
It was just not a good color. And I thought, you know, it's just all this climate change, and, you know, it's a wet year, and things are just screwed up, and, you know, it's just really too bad.
Yeah.
Well, over the fall, I had cataract surgery. But the amazing thing was that it did not occur to me that even though I knew that, you know, I had trouble with my eyes, and I probably even had cataract, it did not occur to me that it was different than what I saw.
Yeah, yeah. So very interesting. And so remember, one of the classic metaphors is that one sees as if through a cataract.
Oh.
Right? That was in the Buddhist tradition, that's one of the metaphors sometimes used.
That
right?
Didn't occur to me
right. So again, we have different presumptions based on our own experience. That was, you know, in a sense, that was somewhat innocent because you didn't know the physical reality, but. Yeah, but still we can make assumptions, go into very complicated thinking, arriving at conclusions and beliefs, all based on being reactive, and that forms our way of seeing the world, right? That's very familiar. Maybe one or two more examples? Anyone else?
Well, at various times, it seems to me, I notice that humanity suffers from this because, or at least the people that I know in humanity, because I can sit in a room and some event might be being discussed.
Yeah.
Trump is always a good example, but I'll try and think of a different...
A little closer to your mouth.
Trump is always a good example.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are many other examples, what the Pope says or what the Dalai Lama says or what anybody, you know, some person says. And if you have a room of diverse thinking people, there might be five interpretations of what the person meant when they said that.
Right.
And, of course, I tend to favor my interpretation of what that person said. But when I'm awake, I'll say, you know, I don't really know what he said. I just have my interpretation of what he said. All these other people have other interpretations, and it's bollocksing because...
Of what he meant or what he said?
Pardon?
Of what he actually said, the actual words, or what he meant?
What he meant.
Yeah, okay.
What he meant.
Okay.
Because, I mean, this is so often the case, and to assume that my interpretation is what he meant is a very risky kind of thing. But then I get stuck because I don't know what to do with the uncertainty of what somebody said or meant.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good.
So that's,
when
that's,
you see that truth,
that's good to look at. Yeah. Yeah, to see that in many ways the mind projecting, coming to conclusions, may be based sometimes on reactivity, sometimes it's based on anxiety about uncertainty. right, needing to know. You know, sometimes, very often, we'd rather know, even if it's inaccurate, rather than not know. Yeah. Maybe one more example? Anyone have another one come to mind, please?
Yeah, I remember being on retreat at Spirit Rock in the early morning at 6.
Yeah.
And there was this beeping sound that sounded electronic to me.
Yeah.
Were you there? And my mind went off. There's too many gadgets, there's too much electronics, someone wasn't careful about the sound system, blah, blah, blah. Is this ever going to end? You know,
right.
I was really upset about it. And then I had a whole lot of projections about people not tending to their business.
Yeah.
And then it turned out it was a cricket.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, cricket.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, oh, this is a natural
phenomenon. This is a nice sound.
Yeah. It also, it became really benign and sort of lovely, you know.
Right.
And it was all my mind.
Right. Anyone who's been on retreat has that happen multiple times. Maybe it doesn't even need a retreat, of course. Maybe right here, because, you know, I remember something very similar. I think I can get it clear, but I was hearing some sounds that I thought were coming from the person in the room, and the next thing, just continually banging on the wall. Right, and I was getting very critical. Should I talk to this person? How inconsiderate, you know. You know, you can. We have versions of this without going on retreat, of course. like your example, at a certain point, I somehow got clear that it was actually the heating system clanking. Wasn't the person. And all of a sudden, whoa. And I just said, whoa, look what I did.
So it's better that it's not a person?
No, I was thinking of, it reminds me of like when I was a kid, and I remember my parents, when we were supposed to be doing our homework, would give us, especially my brother and I, instructions really to keep things quiet. And I'd be in my room, and I thought that I might have heard sounds from my brother making noise, but I couldn't hear well enough to know whether it was really making noise. But I really wanted to listen, because the idea of him not following the rules and me having to do it was so infuriating that I had to go out of my room to just go listen. Is he really doing something? And, you know. So yeah, there was something. So there, it's like it was all these constructions of self. So we get an idea. This is very ordinary. My invitation for next week will be to study these. Study them when they appear in your experience. Study how, because of reactivity, liking, not liking, thinking, having your mind proliferate. And again, I think we're particularly interested in the ones which may be driven by something unpleasant or something pleasant, where the mind just builds up a projection, right? Study these. Take notes on them. Come back with stories. Look into them. This is a very important starting point for just seeing how our minds influence our perception, how our likes, dislikes, reactivity, and so forth, and can learn so much. And it's also, like in my example and your example, just very humbling, right? When you see how, oh, look what I was really worked up for, you know, or your example with the cataracts, right? Or your example too, Theta, with the story of your doctor, right? So that's the first example. A second example, which again is fairly obvious in certain ways, but we also don't always see it so clearly, is to explore how we see things through our social conditioning. Again, we know that we do this, And, you know, some of the most obvious ways we do this are through some of the big categories like gender and race and all sorts of them. A lot of them, you know, come to our attention because they're connected with some kind of injustice, right? But we see in all sorts of ways, some of them connected with injustice and some of them not. But we tend to think that we're seeing just the world accurately, you know, and so, you know, we've studied here sometimes how we look through the lens of what the psychologists call implicit bias. Remember some of our discussions related to race? How we learn at a very young age, you know, and with gender, what it's, you know, it's almost at birth, right? And, you know, and but very, very young, we learn to see in a certain way, we learn to identify ourselves in a certain way, we learn to see certain human beings as other and certain human beings as like us, right? And we project on to both of them certain qualities. The ones that are like us, we tend to give the benefit of the doubt, we think that we know them better, we see them as individuals. The ones that are in the group that's called the group of the others, we tend to see as representatives of the group. We don't see as individuals. We tend to have certain fear or anxiety in relationship to them, and we project on all sorts of things, right? And you can look at the history of all sorts of these categories, whether it's, you know, around race or gender or age or sexual orientation or, you know, issue of how we look at non-human animals, right? Very similar. We look through certain projections that are, and you know, we know that these are different in different cultures. Like these, you know, I was just talking the last few days of someone who had been also spent time, as I have, in the Northwest indigenous culture, where basically they see themselves as really kin of non-human animals, right? And we don't see it that way, right? And so it's a basis, and Patty, you've been very interested in that kind of construction, right? And so, you know, other examples of ways that we don't see accurately because we see through a particular lens or limiting belief related to a collective idea. You can use the mic again.
I'm quite fascinated with all the news about the killings in the school.
A little closer.
The killings in the school get a lot of press attention, and I'm fascinated by all the articles explaining the mindset of people who don't think the way I do. Or I'm in a culture in California and Northern California specifically, the Bay Area specifically, where we tend to think we've got to get rid of the guns.
Yeah.
And there have been a lot of articles by people who think, no, we've got to get better mental health, we've got to get better
right.
checks, that it has nothing to do with the guns. And I know that I am the product of the culture that makes me think, yeah. Well, other countries have as much mental illness as we do, but they don't have this kind of slaughter, but they don't have the guns. So to me, it's perfectly logical to say guns are the issue. But I love reading articles that are pointing out the way people think who don't believe guns are the issue. And I see that I have a cultural bias. It's hard to see through it.
Right.
It's hard to think through the other person's perspective, but I love reading about the fact that they are as committed to their point of view as I am to mine.
Right. No, it's a very good example. And it really, some of you may remember, maybe read George Lakoff, who teaches
yes.
at Berkeley, or maybe he's emeritus now, but he has
yeah,
that
he's
idea.
He's being sued by Trump.
What?
He's being sued by Trump.
He is.
Yeah.
But he's he has that concept of framing that maybe you know, that he says that political discourse occurs through framing, where one sees almost different realities. Right, and there are actually often different words. Like there is what the example would be in terms of immigration. The right wing would talk about chain migration, right, which sounds negative for most people. But on the other side, they talk about what? The reunification of families, right? That's as if they're looking at the same, they're looking at almost like different realities, right? And that Lakoff particularly points that out. I think another example would be the death tax as opposed to the estate tax, right? Right, or, yeah, a lot of that's happening around issues of guns. Again, this isn't to say that there are no facts, right?
There are biases there.
Huh? Right, so it makes me think of, there's a line from a Bob Dylan song, some of you may remember, who says, "Get your facts when someone challenges your imagination." Anyone remember that line?
Oh yeah, the Ballad of a Thin Man.
Right. Okay, very good. And so, other examples. So I'm not saying this to make the thing that everyone just totally lives in their own world and there's no contact with any reality. One easily could go into that view as well. Yeah.
Well, talking about cultural bias.
A little closer to your mouth.
Talking about cultural bias and what we think we are here in the Bay Area, there was a long article on IJ right after the most recent slaughter about how many people ever own guns and support guns. So we think we're in this little bubble of people that are right thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, and we can have all sorts of assumptions, and on this level, in terms of looking at society, looking at the world, looking at other people, it just is almost like there's a filter, a lens, almost from the beginning, isn't there? Right, and so it's helpful to know that. And again, this isn't about getting rid of a framework, but it's about looking at it more carefully, seeing what it is, and then making changes if necessary. Yeah.
I finished George Lakoff's book the other day.
Oh yeah,
and
a little closer.
Don't Think About Elephants.
Right.
And the thing that impressed me the most is biconceptualism.
Yeah.
He says to be able to hold both sides.
That's right.
In your mind simultaneously, and now I think that's marvelous.
Right, the key is going to be, I was thinking of this because before I came to California, I taught for 7 years in Kentucky in rural Ohio.
Wow.
And and one of the classes that I taught in philosophy departments. One of the classes that I taught was ethics. I taught ethics classes, and I remember particularly the ones I taught in Kentucky. And I invited them to have the perspective of respect for other people, respect for other people's points of views and interest in them. In other words, I basically set up a framework of interest in other people's perspectives, dialogue, and empathy as a core framework. I think it's a fundamental way we work with this phenomenon, right? Though, and they accepted that, which was great, right? I had a certain authority. They accepted that. And what I found was that we had fundamentalists. We talked about abortion. We talked about all the hot-button issues. And they were willing to really hear, as long as they knew that other people would listen with some interest rather than just, you know, say, you're going to go to hell, you're damned, or whatever. You know, and I found that the fundamentalists, many of them were really interested in other people's views. They weren't stereotypical fundamentalists. In fact, you know, might not even be called that, but there is that, that's precisely, I think, what's called for here. Can one have one's own perspective but be willing to, as it were, walk in someone else's shoes? And with empathy, know someone else's view. That's really what's called for. So maybe I'll stop there and we'll open it up. But the practice for the second area is try to be really attentive to where you're seeing through a social lens. Again, it can be the lens of the whole culture around something like gender, race, age, sexual orientation, and so forth, or it can be a political perspective, social perspective. And then see if it helps you to shift to an attitude of dialogue, empathy, connection, in taking on, in meeting someone with other views. Right? So these are the kind of what I think to be of the five ways that we may not see things, that we may not see things accurately. These, I think, are two really accessible ways. These are not hard to see. And they're also very connected with our practice, because we, especially, I think, maybe the first time kind, seeing through the lens of self, we really need to, a lot of it we can see right there in our minds when we're meditating, and then really track during the day. So really can be interesting. Some of you may want to specialize on driving. Right. And then so the invitation would be to really take these on as two kinds of inquiries into how our minds work and how in these two fundamental ways we see through projections, beliefs, views, and so forth. Good, so time for questions. Or points, I'm trying to see my recorder just is stopping. Maybe the battery. Okay. Let me take 1 second. Okay. Can formulate your questions more skillfully in the room. Okay, hypothesis proved valid. Okay, comments, questions about any of this, really? Could also be about some of the early discussion of this metaphor of awakening, that we live in a dreamlike reality. Remember, it says dream-like, not dream. They're different. I think so. The implication is that as we see more the ways that we see through the lens of self, we're increasingly able to temper that, So, for example, the practice of dialogue or empathy are very much ways to temper that seeing through the lens of self. I sometimes think of empathy as a fundamental practice that develops not self, in the Buddhist language. Please, Mary.
So, what would it look like? Just a regular person like me was awake.
What would it look like if Mary Page was awake?
Right. I mean, what?
She'd be on the right page.
So just like on a, moment by moment, or in terms of like, say, as driving,
mm-hmm.
when I make it, you know, a judgment about somebody's driving, like, mm-hmm. you know, like one of the things I see in the road and on the freeway when I drive back and forth are these sort of young kids zooming in and out.
Mm-hmm.
And I make judgments about that.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, you've been practicing quite a while.
Right.
So you probably can answer that question yourself. I mean, what you probably have seen a lot of areas in which you're now more awake. And how would you talk about it? Because it's a lot of our, you know, I mean, it may be a lot for us to imagine ourselves as the Buddha, right, or like the Buddha. But I think what keeps us going here is probably that we have actually seen significant development. We've seen areas where we were asleep that we're now awake in, right? And so what would that be for you? If you can see that, then it's really more a matter of just having a sense of it extending or developing further. So what's an area where you've seen significant shift?
Well, I can certainly see, you know, when the judgmental mind kind of pops up and
yeah.
become critical. But, you know, it doesn't feel Buddha-like. It feels just like I'm observing myself be
yeah.
judgmental or reactive.
Yeah. We're, you know, we're moving towards the Buddha. Right? We're moving in that direction. And I think all we want to look for is that where there was lack of clarity, confusion, and so forth, now it's different. And there's movement, there's development. We don't have to have some sense, you know, it's like, we don't have a sense of like, okay, I started at 1 and I go to 10, and 10 represents the Buddha, and I have to feel what the 10 is. All you have to do is feel what the 3 is like, right, or the 4, or the 5. And then you can, and as you do that, you start to get a sense. And man, there can be glimpses at times, especially if one does retreat. So I mean, glimpses of time, you know, you have glimpses. Maybe you're stabilized at 4, but you have a glimpse of 8, right? And that happens, right? You can have glimpses of that, and that sort of gives you a sense of what comes next. Right? And so that I think is how we can kind of be inspired by that. But it's a good question, because it's really pointing to, you know, How do I develop? You know, I mean, I'm presenting these practices as a way to really significantly grow, develop, you know, if we follow them really deeply. And so how do we know that that's happening? That's important. How do we know there are some signs of progress? Right? That's an important aspect of our practice. Yeah. Thanks.